Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack.
Welcome to Top Shelf at Merrick Library. I am your host, Carol Ann Tack, and I am thrilled that you are spending your time here with us today. There are so many options out there for you to listen to, and I am just so grateful that you are here. Back for episode 35, I hosted today's guest, Matthew Norman, for his third novel, Last Couple Standing. But he is the author of two other novels, We're All Damaged and Domestic Violets. So almost 30 episodes later, he's back. And not only is he back, but he's back with his next book called All Together Now. It's a great summer read, and it's perfect because now that you can start being with your friends and your family and your loved ones, I can't think of a better way to embrace all of that with the characters from All Together Now. This book must make it to your beach towel, your picnic blanket, or your headphones, however you can manage to grab a copy of it. The book launches on June 15th, which is on or about the launch for this particular episode, and the early reviews are in, and they are amazing. Amanda Eyre Ward, the best-selling author of The Jet Setters, I love that book, says All Together Now is a delightful novel about the meaning of friendship and how we dream of being remembered. It won me from the first page, a fabulous vacation of a book. Again, that's from Amanda Eyre Ward, the best-selling author of The Jet Setters. And with all that being said, Matthew Norman, thank you so much for coming back to Top Shelf Podcast. I am delighted that you're here.
Well, I'm delighted too. Thank you for having me. This is my pleasure. It's nice to talk to a person. I don't talk to people very often that aren't my wife or my children. So this is a thrill for me. So hello.
Hello to everybody. I'm going to get right to this. I want you to give me the elevator pitch or whatever kind of pitch you want. Tell listeners about All Together Now.
Well, All Together Now is, it's about a lot of things. Most novels are, but I think this book is really just about just the power of enduring friendship. There's something really special about old friends. They're like the sort of siblings that we choose to have, you know, and they see us at our worst and our best. And still, for some reason, years and years later, sometimes decades later, they stick around. They're still parts of your lives. So that was sort of the inspiration. And the book is about four really good old friends from high school, two guys and two women. And they're in their mid-30s now. And one of them, the most successful of the four, is a hedge fund billionaire named Robbie Malcolm. And he discovers that he's dying. And he takes stock of his life. And he decides that he wants to spend the time he has left with the people he cares about most. And so he calls his three oldest friends and brings them to Fenwick Island in Delaware, which they have history there as kids. And he wants to have one last hurrah at the beach. But of course, it's a novel, so it's slightly more complicated than that. He doesn't just want to say goodbye. He has some hidden ulterior motives as well. But yeah, that's the jumping off point. A book about someone dying, but it's also a beach read.
It works. That's what we're looking for. When I received the galley, just like with Last Couple Standing, the first thing I did was look at the cover. I never try to judge a book by its cover, but humanity, and you really can't help it. So I get the galley. I see the cover. I see your name. I didn't read any of the press. It usually comes with a little press sheet that tells folks what the book is about. I put that right to the side, looked at the cover, and dove in. Pardon the expression. Tell me about this cover. You look at it before you read, and then when you're done, go back and look at it again, because there are things you will not have seen the first time around. So what can you tell me about this cover?
Yeah, I really love the cover too. And the right when I saw it, it of all my books, it's the only cover that really hasn't had any changes. Right when I saw it, I was like, yes, that's it. I love it. And I'm a little bit responsible for it too. I don't want to take too much credit because the designers worked very hard and made it much more complicated and interesting than was in my mind. But this book is interesting for me because I'm a comedic novelist and my instincts are always to be, try to be funny and try to have a lot of dialogue and things like that. And this is far and away the most serious subject matter I've ever tackled. And when I was trying to get the book up off the ground, I was just having a lot of trouble finding the tone, you know, because my instincts to be funny were kind of undercutting the subject matter, right? And a couple of years ago. The book is set on Fenwick Island in Delaware, and my wife and I spent a lot of time there with our kids. And we were there, and I was walking around on the beach with my wife and our two idiot dogs, and they were running wild. And I noticed something up on the surf a little, and it was a yellow smiley face beach ball that had been abandoned and sort of marooned there on the sand, that it was turned sideways. And it was a very, very striking picture. And I took a picture with my iPhone, and I, you know, posted it on Instagram at the time, just as just a random picture. But it was just one of those visuals that really stuck with me, because I realized that it really visually encapsulated the tone that I was going for. And it was a great jumping off point for me. At that point, I got the book up off the ground, and I figured out what I wanted to sound like, because it was this sort of airy melancholy. You know, it was a sad thing. It was also kind of funny, but it was weirdly optimistic too. This beach ball that had been lost, but it was still kind of smiling, and it was, you know, it still had air in it. You know, it still was a thing. And I actually wrote it into the book because I liked it so much. So it actually, the beach ball appears twice in the book. And then I sent it to my editor when it came to be, you know, cover time. And I said, hey, you know, this was an important image to me. Maybe check it out. And she sent it to the team as possible inspiration. And lo and behold, I get it, the first proofs, and there it was, right front and center, you know.
When you look at it, you sort of look at it and think, well, this is a wry cover. It's got this wry sense of humor to it. Or you look at the cover and you say, yeah, that's pretty much my day.
Yeah. Right.
We've all seen that beach ball, and you're like, oh boy. Then I see the title. All Together Now. Since we've all suffered through a COVID year, and it's still, the ramifications of that are still affecting us in different ways. I love that the title is All Together Now, which may not have been your chosen thing. Where did the title come from? Was it ever titled something else?
There was definitely a happy accident, what you're talking about. I mean, this idea that we are all now, basically right as the book is coming out, getting back together. You know, our lives are intertwining again. We've been so isolated. And it's been awful, obviously, varying degrees of awful, depending on your personality. I know introverts like me have kind of been okay, but extroverts have just been going crazy. But altogether now, it was never titled anything else. I had a couple of other things in mind that were possibilities. But Altogether Now was perfect for me because there's a Beatles song called Altogether Now. It's not one of their bigger hits, but it's always struck me that it's the inherent irony in the song, because they recorded it in 1967 when they were working on the Sgt. Pepper's album, but they didn't have a place for it on that album, and they didn't have a place for it. It just sort of hung around in their back pockets for 2 years, and they put it on the Yellow Submarine soundtrack album in 1969. And it's a very, very upbeat song, very happy. The four of them sound so happy and so together in that song. But when it was released, they were essentially slowly falling apart. You know, they were less than a year away from no longer being the Beatles. And the inherent irony in that really has followed me around for a couple of years. And I imagined, how would that manifest itself? How would that be a dramatic scenario in real life? And so that's when I imagined this group of friends who find themselves suddenly at the end of what they have always been, because one of them is very ill. So it's a very special title for me, and it's one steeped in kind of Beatles lore. And of course, I wrote their music into the book too.
Which is a wonderful touch. So two things. One, as I would move around the house reading it on the deck or wherever I was, somebody would see the cover and they would start singing the song. It happened every time. So then we'd all start singing the song. So, and that is honest to God, a true story. But so it lends itself to that. But the other thing I was going to ask is, which came first? When did the characters start speaking to you? Did the song come first in this sort of irony of the song in Beatles lore, and then the characters came to you? Which, how did that happen?
Yeah, that's interesting, because I'd have to really think about that, because I've known the song for years,
right?
But I hadn't started thinking about it. And I think that whenever a writer is sort of set to, you know, finishes a book, and then it's like, okay, what is the next book going to be? We start grabbing for things, you know, and it's like, oh gosh, well, this song has always been on my mind for years now. And then it starts to, your mind starts to spin on it. And, you know, there was another thread of thinking I had where I have always found this phenomenon with me. Whenever a wealthy or famous person passes away, of anything other than being, you know, very, very old, my initial reaction is always, how could that have happened to them? They're so rich, you know. Nice. And intellectually, I know that's ridiculous because just wealth alone doesn't inoculate you from, you know, plane crashes and car wrecks and drug overdoses, et cetera. But there was something to that initial reaction. So I started thinking about the Robbie character. And I think altogether now, the music was in my head. And I just been listening to the Beatles a lot lately, actually, because the Beatles channel started on Sirius XM a couple of years ago. Yes. And it's when I'm writing, I always have music on. And the Beatles are perfect to just sort of put in the background. They're a very just an intellectually stimulating band, you know. And I think it's just all of those threads of thinking crashing together at once. But all together now, and the irony of that song has been in my head for years. So I would say the short answer to that question is that song came first, for sure.
And how soon after Last Couple Standing? Because that book is still vibrant in my mind. Listeners, you have two options: to go back to listen to episode 35, find the book and read it and do like a companion piece thing, because the people in that book still stay with me. And there are some very funny scenes. I won't say anything more than that. But I think Last Couple Standing came out before the pandemic.
It came out on, I remember this well, believe me, it came out on St. Patrick's Day of 2020, which happened to be essentially the day that the entire world shut down. Like every bookstore in America closed, because St. Patrick's Day is such a social event. It sort of forced everyone's hand, right? The businesses had to be like, we have to close down or there's going to be 1,000 drunk idiots running around the streets. And so the world closed the day my book came out.
So I must have hosted you before everything shut down.
It was like 10 days before. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And I must have gotten the edits really quick and pushed it out there, because then, and I remember when the library closed, I think it was on the 13th. It was Friday the 13th. And the first thing I grabbed out of the library, I didn't even grab my pocketbook or my cell phone. I grabbed all my podcast equipment and loaded up the truck and then went back in. Nice. So now your book comes out during this pandemic. When do you decide to start writing altogether now?
Not to get too far into the weeds of the publishing industry, but when I sold Last Couple Standing several years ago, I also sold a next book, which I hadn't written. It was a two-book deal, the first one of my career, which was fantastic. And I had, when I sold Last Couple Standing, I'd included a little pitch of what I thought the next book would be. And that ended up being Altogether Now. And then because I was with a new publisher for Last Couple Standing, that book basically sat ready to go for about a year and a half before it got published, just because it had to kind of get in line, right, on the schedule. And so I had lots of time. And so by the time, you know, that book came out, Last Couple Standing, I was well into this book, and which is, so it created, just because of the circumstances, it created this little bit of illusion that I am this writer who's going to be publishing novels once a year, but that's probably not going to happen. It was just fortunate timing. So I could turn two out pretty quickly.
The setup of the book, and actually Jessica Anyablau said it in one of her reviews, which I thought the same thing, that the setup kind of reminds me of The Big Chill, for those of us at a certain age who remember seeing The Big Chill. Because you've got characters like Robbie, who is bringing everyone together for this long weekend, the secrets start to roll. And with that are the reader's assumptions, in this case, my assumptions about the characters. And then those assumptions change. Thank you so much, Matthew Norman, for doing that to us. Except for the kids, really, because I loved the kids and I loved Dash. I don't know where you get Dash from, but man, he had...
Dash was, I read somewhere that when somebody becomes a billionaire, customarily they have what's called a body man, somebody that essentially follows them around, becomes their bodyguard. Because once you're a billionaire, you're kind of famously wealthy and you could get kidnapped for ransom and stuff like that. And I love that idea of this big sort of burly person just kind of following you around in your daily life and always being there. And so I decided to kind of have fun with that. And I gave him a backstory and I had him be there all the time because he's not intimately involved with this group of four friends, but he's there all the time. And so he gets kind of woven into the story and woven into their lives. That's where that came from. Just the idea of a billionaire's body man.
One of the things I think about both of the books that I read, Last Couple Standing and this one Altogether Now, is how visual they are for me. You have these visuals around a very funny scene, like the scene where they're dancing. I don't know, as an author, how technically difficult or not that is to do? Like, were you sort of walking around with your wife and the kids and said, oh, let's, you know, like, how does that work?
I think that different writers excel at different things, and they have, you know, weaknesses and strengths, and they just have a way of thinking about the world and laying stories out. And I have always been a very linear thinker, and I also tend to think in terms of scenes. And I think that comes down to the fact that, you know, being a kid of the late 70s and 80s, I was raised on TV and movies in a sense, you know, and I love reading. Obviously, it's one of my favorite things to do. But in the amount of time it takes me to read a good novel, especially a big novel, I might watch three movies with my wife and kids. I might watch five episodes of some great show like The Handmaid's Tale or whatever. So the point is, my imagination was shaped around seeing things unfold and seen. And so I tend to not have a lot of exposition, not a lot of narration. When I do have that, I find myself kind of struggling and just being uncomfortable and end up cutting a lot of it out anyway. So I just think that I tend to see the movie in my head. I'm one of those type of writers. And I think some of the writers tend to think about ideas and exposition and backstory and where this character came from. I tend to just put everybody together in a room and let them sort of fight it out.
The other thing you do in this book, yes, it is about the power of these enduring friendships, but you bring up parenting. And I love that you do that. The take on parenting and Altogether Now, there's so many of these beautiful sentences. And there's two in particular. The book is filled with these. I mean, my book has more post-its than you can shake a stick at, but there are two sentences about parenting, and both of them gave me a lump in my throat. The first one is, parenthood has a way of turning your brain into a dread-seeking machine. Boy, is that should be on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
You can say that about anything that you love and, you know, whatever your precious cargo is, but parenthood has a way of turning your brain into a dread-seeking machine. Absolutely right. And then this other one, it's towards the end of the book. You say, it's one of a million small miracles of parenthood. You have no idea how much you want to see your kids until you, in fact, see your kids. And I found that so poignant. It's a gift of a sentence. Where does that come from? Is it just...
I think it's just thinking about parenthood, because I'm a parent and my kids are 9 and 11 years old. And which is sort of an in-between age. And I know that those two sentences came from Blair's perspective. She's one of the characters, the only one of the characters who has children. And she has twin five-year-olds. So she was dealing with, you know, some younger kids. But I think it's just thinking about parenthood and how much parenthood changes you psychologically. And parents always have this desire to be like, oh, if I just had a week without these kids, I could relax, I could read, I could do whatever I wanted. And a lot of us have the opportunity to have that sometimes, like our in-laws come into town and watch the kids. You guys go off and have fun, you know? And there's always this phenomenon of like 4 days of having a good time and sort of being casually drunk for like 4 days, you know, all the stuff you can't do when you watch movies and you read books. And then like that fifth day, you're like, oh my God, I wonder what Caroline and Hazel are doing. You just start thinking about your kids, and then you see them and it's like, oh, I do like you guys. In fact, I love you guys. You know, you're wonderful little monsters. And so as much as we think we want to get away from them sometimes, like, oh, we need them, you know.
To that point of that dread-seeking machine, as a parent, Blair's got these young twins. You've got your 11-year-old and in that age group. And I've got my 20-something-year-olds. And no matter what age, there is still that potential for, oh my gosh, what if this happens? Oh my gosh, my son's going camping this week. And I'm thinking, please, you're going on
absolutely
a long drive. Make sure you wear your seatbelt. He's like, Mom, I'm 26. I'm like, I know, just be careful. You know, it doesn't... You've become hardwired into this. And so I thought, wow, Matthew Norman gets it. He know, and of course you're speaking through Blair.
Sure.
Which I love. She's great. Team Blair. And then the other thing is, you don't know how much you want to see your kids until in fact you see your kids. So you do miss them and you like them as people for the most part, right?
You do for the most part.
For the most part. There is always that caveat, right? And so I do appreciate the take on parenting because you tackle so much. You tackle the power of friendship. You tackle grief. You tackle secrets. And then you bring parenting into that mix. So I appreciate that as a reader. And I think that I think that readers will find that also. And then you have something else where you say it's Wade. And Wade has just had something absolutely wonderful for him happen. And he says, what a staggering realization happiness can be, like what lottery winners must feel as they read and reread their numbers. Come on, Matthew Norman, what are you doing to us?
I'm sorry, but I think that this book is the first time I've ever had this is the most characters that I've ever given perspectives to, you know? And so there's four characters that get essentially screen time. And that allowed me to kind of give each of the four different personalities, obviously, and the ability to sort of talk about different things through each of them. And so Wade is a failed novelist. He published one book and has just kind of crapped out creatively since, and he just can't get anything else off the ground. And so I could talk about that and just the melancholy that comes with sort of failing at the one thing that you kind of thought that you were meant to do, you know. And, you know, Blair, I got to talk about parenthood, and it was really fun to do that and to have just so many characters. And it was, you know, difficult and complicated at times, and it took a lot of rewriting, you know, because in early drafts, it's pretty common that all the characters kind of sound the same. They sort of sound like you. And my editor pointed out to me early on when she read a first draft, she's like, all of the characters sound like Kat. And Kat is one of the four main characters, and she's the funniest of the four. And I think I was trying to just make a funny, fun book. And it's like, well, I'll make them all funny. And then, well, they can't all be Kat, and they can't all be the same kind of funny, and they can't all have the same personality. And so rewriting and rewriting and rewriting kind of develop their own personas. And Wade is definitely that tipped over smiley face beach ball. He's like, everything is awful and everything is going to continue to be awful. And then when this good thing happens, it's like, oh my God, I guess good things are possible, you know?
He is the beach ball. And he just so happens to be very best friends with a billionaire, which that juxtaposition of each of the characters relating to their friend who they knew in high school is now a billionaire. And it really leads to some head scratching moments for them. The other thing you bring in and you tackle amazingly well is marriage. So you've got Blair and Blair's husband. When you are writing these characters and you hit the mark, do you know right away? I know you said that there are a lot of edits and revisions that have to be done, but when you hit the mark, it must happen differently for each character.
You find the voices you're writing, you know, and each character kind of hit their stride at different times. Like I said, Kat, I nailed, I think, pretty early, so much so that I made all of the characters Kat, essentially. And so I'm like, okay, well, Kat is good. Now I got to work on these other ones. And far and away, the most difficult and the one that I had to work on the most and use my imagination the most was Robbie, the billionaire, because I think that's just a case of him being, of all the characters, the furthest away from anything that I've ever experienced. I'm not a billionaire. I'm not a math genius. I'm not a hedge fund person. You know what I'm saying? So he was the one that, if I had to list attributes, were polar opposite from me. And so I had to really use my imagination. And there are some famous billionaires out there. I mean, there's a famous billionaire here in Baltimore, the founder of Under Armour, was a guy named Kevin Plank. And there is a real charisma and power and movie star quality to a lot of the billionaires that we know as a society, just like these famous sort of rock star billionaires. But I didn't want Robbie to be like that. I wanted him to be a math person. I wanted him to be sort of a nerd who had hit it big kind of thing. And I don't know that person. You know, I don't have a model for him, right? So I had to just kind of create him from the ground up. And that was just a ton of rewriting. I mean, my editor, Ann, late in the many drafts in, was like, we don't have Robbie yet, you know? And I'm like, oh, damn it, you're right. You know, so I just kind of go back and I'm like, this draft, I'm just focused on the Robbie chapters. And I think he eventually came together. He was very elusive for me.
I love that the editor is reading it that way and saying, you know, let's find Robbie because he shows up. So kudos to the editor because, man.
Thank you, Ann Spire. Yes,
Ann Spire. That's amazing. The first chapter of the book, was that always going to be the first chapter? Did you have something else?
That was always the first chapter.
It really was. Wow.
It was. And that's how I imagined it. And I wrote that first chapter and I wrote, you know, 50 some odd pages, which is sort of what I do. And then I show it to my editor and she questioned that. not in a way that she immediately didn't like it, but she was like, the first scene could be anything, right? And so she's like, well, is this the first scene? Should this be? And I thought, I don't remember if I did any free writing for different openers, but I thought about different openers. And it ended up being this, what it was always in my mind. And that just really seemed like the introduction to me.
Absolutely right. The listeners can't see, but I see the post-its behind you on your bulletin board. And I'm thinking, oh, is that a plot up there? Do I see characters?
That is a plot.
It is.
It is a plot. Each of those represents sort of like a scene or a discussion, or that's one of my processes, very note card oriented. And because I'm a very linear thinker and I like to see it all there. And so I put little note cards, and each note card represents an argument, a scene, a car ride in which something was revealed, et cetera, that kind of thing. And so I lay it all out linearly. And that way I can just sort of sit in this chair and stare up at, which I do a lot.
As you get deeper, how much of the corkboard do you actually see by the time you start? Probably not much.
Not much. That's a problem. And a lot of them get consolidated as I go, because I realize that this conversation and this conversation and this car ride could all be the same thing. And so that ultimately happens. What will be like maybe 100 stupid, scratch, terrible handwriting, little note cards up on the wall might actually become like 62 or something like that, because there's a lot of consolidating that happens. But
I have pretty intense reading glasses, but I cannot make out a single word on any of those post-its, and it's not from lack of trying. Trust me.
my handwriting is ridiculous. It is so terrible, and I jot things down very quickly. Then I look at them. I'm like, I don't know what that is, and I leave notes for my wife, and she's like, I don't know what this says. She'll text me, What is this? Did a toddler write this? Awful handwriting. It's a crutch. I learned to type when I was very young, so actually handwriting is very difficult for me.
That's funny. The year of COVID, were you writing a lot of this during 2020?
I was. Yeah, I was writing a ton of it. I'd have to really think it through, but yeah, definitely. I mean, most of the book was written during 2020. And, for me, I was fortunate, because if I had toddlers, for example, it would be a whole different story. But, I have kids who are a little bit older who don't need that sort of second to second parenting that, young kids need. And so I just kind of was able to go to work every day. My wife has a job where she works down in the kitchen. She's on Zoom all day long. And I'm up here, doing what I do. And for a while, the kids were on online school, and then they went back to school with masks and stuff. So for me, it really, COVID was kind of in terms of writing, it was a little bit of a business as usual scenario. I was fortunate to be able to do that.
And as we mentioned earlier, the irony of the title altogether now was not entirely lost on you.
I know. We're back. We're back, baby. We can see our friends. We can do stuff. If you live in Baltimore or near Baltimore, on June 15th at 7 p.m., I will be at the Ivy Bookshop in Baltimore, which is a fantastic bookstore. And it's one of the few bookstores in the country, really, that has kind of opened up for these sort of events, because they have a really big back patio and a outdoor kind of a field that they've taken over, and it's lovely, and they have book events back there. So it's one of the rare spots, I think, in the country where you can have a book launch in an outdoor, safe, socially distanced situation.
You're the first author I've interviewed who actually said, I will be at such and such, instead of on Zoom or via Zoom or, the Crowdcast. You're the first one who said, I'm going to be at the Ivy Bookstore in Baltimore.
So Google the Ivy and All Together Now, and you'll find that you have, because of COVID restriction, capacity restrictions, right, you have to actually get a ticket. So if you're in the Baltimore area, please come see me. It'll be great. And then 2 days later, on June 17th, I am doing a digital event kind of for the rest of the world. I'll be in conversation with Jessica Anya Blau, which should be great, because she's fantastic and she's just funny and crazy. And her new book, Mary Jane, is fantastic.
Oh, I listened to the audio. I can't believe how great it was.
I read it. Was the narrator young sounding? That's fantastic. Because their narrator's like 14 or 15 year old girl.
She was terrific. She was so good. And she sounded like, I don't know how old she is in her life, but certainly in this book, she embraces Mary Jane. She becomes Mary Jane for the listener. Absolutely nailed it.
That's fantastic. So I'm really excited about that event with Jessica. Jessica and I have been friends for years. We've just sort of had books come out around the same time for a while. And for a while, I think we had the same publisher. And she used to live in Baltimore, so I would like see her at the grocery store. And she actually gave me the title Last Couple Standing for my last book. I ran into her at a coffee shop, and I was in the middle of writing. I was late in writing that book, and I told her what the premise, and I told her the title I had at the time. And she's just like, no, I don't like that. You should call it Last Couple Standing. And it's like, she didn't brainstorm. She didn't have to think. She just said it in a matter of 5 seconds. And I was like, oh my God, you're totally right. That should absolutely be the title of the book. So she gets credit for that one. She was in the acknowledgments for that one, for coming up with the title.
Wow. That's an amazing pedigree. I love hearing that. Can listeners find your website, or what's the website that they can go to find some of these things?
TheNormanNation.com is it's a sort of a blog/website. And that does have, you know, the information. And you can also get like the ticketing information to the two events. But I'm a social media creature. I'm definitely on all of the social media sites. The Norman Nation is both my Twitter and my Instagram handle. If you like pictures of corgis, I recommend my Instagram handle. I have two dogs, one of which is a corgi who's just like a cartoon character. So I constantly post pictures of him.
And there's of them chasing you, I don't know, in front of the garage or something.
Yeah. That was a video. I decided to get pretty sick. So I had my wife, I'm like, I have an idea. So I give my phone to my wife. I said, film this. And I ran, because my dogs, if you start running, they will chase you for whatever you're running after. And so I just ran, and the dogs chased me like they were chasing after me. And it was, so I post a lot of things like that. Now I'm posting about the book a lot, but you know, it's like dogs, dogs, dog book, dogs, 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 you know, so.
Wait till the Bookstagram takes off with this cover. You're going to find everywhere the creativity on Instagram for book covers like blows my mind. They are terrific. Before I let you go, can you share any book recommendations to listeners?
Well, we just talked about Mary Jane, which is fantastic. That's out in hardcover now. I have been on a big Emily St. John Mandel kick. She is fantastic. I mean, she's so good. And she's so literary. I mean, she's creating literature, but she does it in a very accessible way. So I've been on a huge kick for her lately. The Glass Hotel was the one that I read the latest, and it was wonderful. Yeah, Station 11 is an interesting book to read during a global pandemic, too, because it starts out, it's similarly to how COVID did, but it gets obviously much, much, much worse. But so it is creepy in that sense.
Does she weave magic towards the end, middle to the end of that book, Station 11, the magic she weaves is just...
It's amazing. Yeah, I've never met her or talked to her in any way, but I would love to just think about, because a lot of times when I read, you know, as a writer reading books, I'm constantly thinking like a writer. It's like, how did she do this? How did she lay this out? Because I think so linearly, like I said before, and I would suspect maybe she doesn't. I think that her mind is probably different than the way I put things together. But I'm a huge Emma Straub fan. I thought her book, All Adults Here, was fantastic. I love that book. And there's so many. My to-be-read pile, there's so many great books out now, right? And so I just keep buying them, and they just pile up, and eventually my nightstand is going to collapse next to my bed or something. But there's so much great stuff to read.
Not to mention the post-it notes behind you saying, we're here, don't forget.
Yeah, that's right. I should look at those and maybe write a book too.
Yeah, just maybe, just in case. But you know what? We'll be here for whatever comes next, hopefully. I am so honored that you're here. I will post all of this information on the podcast page for this episode. Before I wrap up, I do want to share this quote from Nancy Thayer. Everyone knows Nancy Thayer. She is the best-selling author of Family Reunion. And she says, Matthew Norman's new novel, All Together Now, is fast, fun, and wise. The perfect summer read. I totally agree with that. Matthew, I'm so honored that you came back to Top Shelf at Merrick Library to share All Together Now. Thank you so much.
No, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, folks, today's book, All Together Now, by today's two-time guest, Matthew Norman, hit shelves on June 15th. So grab a copy at your local library or your local independent bookstore. All Together Now is published by Ballantine Books, which is an imprint of Random House. Thank you all for joining me today. Remember to follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library on Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and wherever you find most podcasts. That the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library, check out our website, merricklibrary.org. Special thanks to Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Diane Bondi, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and onto the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.